Sheffield Live, made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3, here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X.
Poetry in motion. Turn a tender eyes to me. Steam as any ocean. Sweet as any harmony. But you blinded me with silence.
She blinded me with silence.
Good morning, welcome Good morning. To the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You've got Julian Paul here live in the studio as usual. We'll speaking to RPG later in this hour. We've got our guest speaker this week is Chris Dale, and he's going to join us more or less straight away. Great. So let's see if he's there. Good morning, Chris.
Morning, team. Oh, how yeah. are you?
Do you know what? It went quiet then, Chris. We were worried.
Ooh.
We're very well. How are you?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, can hear you.
Brilliant.
We can hear you loud and clear. Thanks for joining us once again, Chris.
Yeah, well, today I'm here to talk about the banning of multi-buy promotions on unhealthy food and drink.
Yes.
So this is something that we've spoken about so much in the past, haven't we? So I thought I'd talk about that. So the restrictions will apply to supermarkets, larger high street shops and online retailers and even some restaurants, and I'll get onto that later. So the measure to put a restriction on buy one, get one free has been under consideration for years, but it's been put on hold because of the cost of living crisis. Ministers argue the restrictions are an important step to tackle obesity and in particular childhood obesity. The regulations also ban free refill promotions of certain drinks in restaurants and cafes. But how we must have been speaking about this now for, what, over 2 years, Julie?
It may even be more, Chris, can you believe?
Might even be more, yeah. And finally, something's starting to happen. But the good thing is that this ban will also, they will also put a ban on advertising of less healthy food and drinks on television before 9 o'clock. And they're also going to put a complete ban of online promotions from January 2026.
Wow, well, that's an interesting one. Long time coming.
Very long time coming. A Department of Health and Social Care spokesman said the restrictions were a crucial step in giving children a healthy, happy start to life. Obesity robs children of the best possible start in life and sets them up for a lifetime of health problems and costs the NHS billions of pounds a year. I think they might have been listening to us over the,
I think you've influenced them tremendously, Chris. It's just, you'll be having your own TV show next.
Well, I'm quite happy just doing this. So the government has also introduced a classification system and which will define what food and drinks are classed as unhealthy, which is based upon the products thought to have the most influence on child obesity. So obviously those are things that are very high in sugar, high in salt and high in fat. So in terms of drinks, it includes fizzy drinks such as lemonade and Coca-Cola. For the food, it covers everything from crisps, sweets, chocolates, ice cream, pastries, cakes, fish fingers and even pizzas. But what I wanted to say was one of the questions that I got asked was, why don't supermarkets do healthy bog-offs? And actually, supermarkets, they do promotions on healthier food and particularly fruit, but they often don't do promotions on vegetables. And that's simply because they don't have a long shelf life. So, for instance, if you had buy one cauliflower, get another one free, the second cauliflower is likely to deteriorate very quickly and not be used and therefore would be considered to be food waste. And that's the reason that supermarkets don't do bog-offs on vegetables.
Oh. Oh, interesting.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. So, but they do bog-offs on fruit, and they do because fruit has a longer shelf life than the vegetables and salads and that sort of thing. So, as we've discussed so many times on this program, obesity rates have risen sharply over recent decades across the world, with more than a quarter of adults and a fifth of children at the end of primary school classed as obese. And we go back to our good friend Greg Fell, president of the Association of Public Health Directors.
He used to be our Sheffield Public Health Director.
That's right.
Yeah.
It was, yeah. He pops up everywhere, so he's one of our superheroes. But he said that this move should not be seen as a silver bullet, but it was long overdue, arguing it should not have been delayed from 2022 in the first place. And he said, multi-buy promotions do not actually save people money. In fact, they are designed to encourage people to spend more. So they're designed to encourage impulsive purchases and to normalize buying more and more frequently. He said he hoped retailers would now turn the tide towards healthier products. And I've just lost my place.
Oh, healthy products to make healthier choices easier for us all. That's Chris, right. Or something like that, I'm sure. But before we move on then, Chris, it's an interesting one though. But the problem is the palates of children in particular, and even adults, some of people's palates, they're like absolutely tuned in to ultra-processed food and sugar and salt and fat. And they don't want a cauliflower, do they?
Yeah. No, absolutely, and that's another issue.
So, as Greg Fell says, it's a start, but actually, you've got to look at it even further.
Absolutely, and so again, he refers to the fact that obesity rates have risen at an unprecedented rate over the years, and we're now a key driver of health inequality, as people in more deprived areas are nearly twice as likely to be obese.
Which sounds really bizarre, doesn't it? In a way,
Yeah. Processed food is so much cheaper to buy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we always refer to that stat, don't we, where to make a lemon drizzle cake at home, it costs you £4.20. And for them to make it in a factory, it costs them 23 pence.
Because it doesn't have lemons and it's just chemicals.
It only has chemicals in it.
We laugh, but it's it's a serious issue, Chris, isn't it?
Yeah. And he basically says, you know, this is a long overdue first step, it's still a long way. The government is still a long way from its manifesto commitment to end junk food advertising to kids. But as we know, that's going to be starting in January 2026. University of Leeds published early, a study by University of Leeds, which we published earlier this year, looked at the impact of the measures introduced in 2022 as planned, which was the ban on unhealthy products at key locations, such as checkouts, aisles, aisle ends and store entrances. And what they found that before, about 20 of every 100 items, so, you know, we're talking something in the order of 20% of all items were classed as unhealthy, and this has now dropped to 18. And they say that there's now been 2 million fewer products bought per day because of stopping, having this advertising aisles and all that sort of thing. But there has been industry lobbying of government against the restriction over the years. And what a surprise, because we've had that with alcohol, we've had it with cigarettes, we've had it with fast food, we've had it as gambling. What they're saying is that they should be allowed to introduce their own restrictions. And again, we've heard that before. So some of the retailers, including Sainsbury's and Tesco, have already introduced their own restrictions. And I have a quote here that says, food retailers are supporting their customers to make healthier choices through better calorie labelling, reformation of products and portion control. And I've put a big really, because when I saw that, I went into my local supermarket to look at what retailers are actually doing to try and encourage healthier choices. And I sent you a photograph, didn't I, Julian?
You did, yes.
Of the biggest promotion for Crave cereal, which is nothing but sugar, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And then next to it was a promotion for sweets for Halloween. And did you see all the bright colours and all the offers saying if you buy three of them, it's £5 and all that sort of stuff? So actually, I couldn't just having read that quote that they're trying to get people to make healthier choices. I went to a supermarket and took photographs of so many promotions, and it was all ultra processed food, sugar and rubbish.
And chemicals. Yeah. Yeah, I know.
So when they keep saying, so these people that keep saying, oh yes, we're going to manage things, we're going to manage it ourselves, it's just a load of rubbish, isn't it?
Well, it is, and all these things, they're addictive, aren't they? Alcohol, you talk about why the manufacturers and are lobbying against it, because everything that they're trying to sell is addictive. Cigarettes, tobacco, fast food is basically addictive.
It is.
And that's why, no matter that people still want to do it. So it's a difficult one, because are people still going to buy? It might be more expensive if there's no offers, but are people going to still buy ultra-processed foods and stuff that's bad for them?
It is. Well, we do know that some of the retailers are making changes to the way that they produce ready meals and that sort of thing, trying to make them healthier. And we've spoken about that before. But the bottom line is, it's the cost. And if people are used to buying this cheaper junk food, which fills them up, which means that they can feed a family and that everybody's eating and they've got full bellies at night, you can't really blame anybody. It's just that's just the way it goes. The sad thing about it is that it then becomes addictive.
Yeah, yeah.
And people just get so used to it. And it does put a long-term problem onto the NHS, doesn't it? And we've discussed that in previous things as well.
And, one of the most startling things or facts that's come up in the years we've been talking about this ultra-processed foods and the impact of your diet on your health is the fact that a lot of children who are obese or severely obese, they're actually malnourished. So they're overweight.
That's right.
But they're suffering from malnourishment because everything they're eating has got no nutritional value in it. And I find that shocking.
Very limited nutritional value, And that's why a lot of schools, why it's so important that schools and cake, because schools now are doing healthier food and introducing vegetables and things like that into the school diet, because in some cases, if that didn't happen, some people wouldn't be having any fresh vegetables at all.
No, and that's a terrible thing. But the government's obviously starting to intervene, but is it enough, Chris? We might ask.
Well, I think the thing that I would say is, you look at it in the round, no, we're not doing enough. And again, when I walked around the supermarket, I saw how many shelves was dedicated to crisps, cereals, sweets, alcohol.
Yeah.
You know, all the things that we consider really bad. And actually, on those aisles, there were loads of promotions. You went to the vegetable aisle and it was just one aisle. One half was vegetables, one half was salads, and that was it.
Yeah, amazing.
So they're not putting the same effort in.
They're not putting their money where their mouth is. Yeah, go on, Chris.
But we have to also remember that a lot of our pensions and investments are in foods like Coca-Cola, McDonald's, that sort of stuff, because they are safe. They are considered to be safe investments at the moment.
It's interesting. So you also sent me the other link, that Pizza Hut's closing 68 UK restaurants. So obviously they've been listening. Some people have been listening to you, Chris, and thought, that's it, I'm not going to Pizza Hut no more. But yeah.
Maybe it's because there's now so many pizza chains.
It's probably true. But the other thing that caught my eye this week, funnily enough, was Penguin bars can no longer be called chocolate because the cocoa content is not high enough. I thought, I'm sure there's some other reasons. Go on.
Well, it's because cocoa's so expensive.
It is.
It's something like tripled in price over the last sort of few years. So a lot of people are reducing the cocoa content.
Yeah, but what are they replacing it with, you might ask? You know, I've not looked on a label, but I wonder if it's a few more chemicals, Chris.
We'll send you
penguins next time. You go out. I bet they're going to stop you going in supermarkets. So, God, it's him again. He's taking photographs of our displays. Brilliant, Chris. Thanks so much for doing that for us, Chris. Now, you've chosen a track to play out on. Do you want to tell people what it is?
You better make the right one.
Well, it's a Dutch band. They're from the 1970s. They're called White Honey, and the song's called Two Together, because obviously we were talking about Bog-Offs, which where you buy two together.
Excellent. And it came from the Cha-Cha soundtrack, which was a film by Herman Brood.
Excellent. And Nina Hagen.
And Nina Hagen. What a combination. Thanks a lot, Chris. Enjoy your weekend. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye. Dutch band there, White Honey, with a track called Two Together Live. And Chris chose that track because he was talking about buy one, get one free deals for unhealthy food to be banned. all interesting stuff. Of course, you're listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital, if you're in South Yorkshire, sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning from 11 until 12. Next week, and indeed every first Saturday of the month, our guest speaker will be Phil Moffitt from the Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society. He's been up to all sorts with his telescope, and he's been capturing all sorts of amazing images, and he's going to be telling us all about it next Saturday, fingers crossed. Later in the show, we'll be talking to RPG a bit later than usual, but before that, quite a few things to mention. First off, before I forget, Sheffield Photographic Society. We have Gareth Morgan on as our guest speaker the third Saturday of every month, generally. Just to remind folks that their Perspectives exhibition for this year starts at the Sheffield Winter Gardens on Friday the 31st of October, so that's next Friday, and it runs until Sunday the 9th of November. It's free and it's cracking stuff. Some great photography there, well worth a visit. Also to remind people that British summertime ends tomorrow, Sunday the 26th of October 2025, that is if you're listening on catch up, the clocks fall back by 1 hour at 2 a.m.
And tomorrow, Sunday the 26th of October at 12 noon and 2 p.m, Elsica's Grey Engine is back in action tomorrow. The Newcomb Beam Engine at Elsica is the oldest steam engine still in its original location in the world. Invented by Thomas Newcomb to pump water from the coal mines, it was the first ever practical engine. Learn more about this fascinating invention, its story at Elsica and how it would have worked. The tour lasts 1 hour and costs £6 per person. So if you Google Elsica Heritage Centre at barnsley.gov.uk, you'll be
find out. He's, I feel it might have been booked up, yeah, but it's well worth going to do it. Next up in the science news this week, UK breakthrough in nuclear fusion. Very, very interesting article. On a former military airfield a few miles south of Oxford, a group of scientists are trying to bottle the sun. Not literally, of course, but their ambitions come close. Inside a 4-metre-tall apple-shaped machine known as the Mega Amp Spherical Tokamak Upgrade, or MAST-U for short, they are attempting to recreate, control and ultimately commercialise the fusion reactions that power the stars. In the past few weeks, they have made landmark progress. And now nuclear fusion is physics' grand prize, promising a virtually limitless carbon-free source of energy. The idea is amazingly simple, can you believe? Hydrogen atoms are squeezed together so that they merge or fuse to become helium. A tiny portion of mass is lost along the way and converted into a great deal of energy without leaving behind long-lived radioactive waste. The challenge lies in persuading fusion to happen. The fuel, which is the atoms of hydrogen, must be heated to tens of millions of degrees until it becomes a plasma, a churning charged state of matter so hot that no solid wall can contain it. The only way to confine such a temperamental substance is with magnetism. So the MAST-U team, and MAST-U, as I will remind you, stands for Mega Amp Spherical Tokamak Upgrade, has announced what the UK Atomic Energy Authority, or UKAEA, which runs the experiment, is calling a major breakthrough. For the first time in a spherical tokamak, a more compact type of fusion machine than the larger donut-shaped devices other researchers have focused on, they have used small magnetic coils to stabilise the plasma's outer edge. And until now, that edge has been where the trouble has started. Just as the sun occasionally belches great flares of charged particles into space, so the plasma inside a fusion reactor can erupt with what physicists call edge-localised modes, or ELMs, sudden explosions of heat and energy. Left unchecked, these edge-localised modes, or ELMs, would fry the inner walls of a future power plant, causing the fusion reaction to stop. But the MAST-U team have shown that by applying precise three-dimensional ripples to the magnetic field, which is known as resonant magnetic perturbations, they can quiet these tantrums altogether. In another world first, the team have also shown that the machine's upper and lower diverters, its exhaust ports, basically, can be controlled independently, allowing heat and particles to be managed once the hydrogen fuel is spent. In a fusion plant, this control will be key. If the plasma hits the side of the reactor, the machine will be damaged and the plasma will collapse. Now, Fulvio Militello, who's Executive Director of Plasma Science and Fusion Operations at the UK Atomic Energy Authority, said, "These achievements reinforce the UK's leadership in fusion research and bring us closer to realising nuclear fusion as a clean, safe and abundant energy source for the future." I thought that was a fascinating story. Elsewhere in the news then, Paul.
Yes. Yes, blind people are able to read again after having a tiny microchip inserted in the back of their eyeball in a medical breakthrough heralding a new era of treatment. The patients were living in darkness before the trial, involving a team at Moorfields Eye Hospital in London, but they can now recognise faces, do crosswords and read books.
Amazing. Wow. Elsewhere, the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere jumped by a record amount last year, amid growing concern that forests and other carbon sponges, as they're known, are starting to fail. Atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide gas, or CO2, which are the main driver of climate change, increased by a record 3.5 parts per million, or ppm, between 2011 and 2020. The average rise was 2.4 parts per million per year. Wow.
Ooh, ooh. Right, water buffalo have been introduced on Exmoor as part of a rewilding project to restore farmland back to its original wetland state. The National Trust said that the buffalo would act as wetland architects due to their ability to churn soil, create shallow pools of water and clear scrub.
And finally, this was a great article, I thought. There are 41 million active gardeners in Britain, which is quite a statistic, actually. Combined, our pottering about the garden, basically meeting nature halfway, can make a big difference. Apologies for whatever noises that is. It is live radio. I think somebody's drilling outside. Never mind. Back to the story. So, yeah, combined, our pottering about the garden, with basically meeting nature halfway, can make a big difference. And this week, the Royal Horticultural Society, or the RHS for short, published a report which confirmed exactly how much of a difference us gardeners make in our daily gardening, or weekly, whatever your choice is. The charity has for the first time mapped Britain's gardens and established that private domestic gardens cover 503,000 hectares, which is 2.4% of the British landmass, and get this, 60% bigger than the country's national nature reserves. That is more space put together than every park allotment and school ground in the country, and it's packed with nature. Domestic gardens are biodiversity hotspots and climate allies, say the RHS, holding 19 million trees and providing habitats for more than 40% of Britain's bird and mammal species and more than half of butterfly, amphibian and reptile species. There are also huge carbon sinks which store an estimated 158 million tonnes of carbon in the soil and plants, equivalent hectare to hectare to a 30-year-old native woodland. But if you think that all sounds amazing, and it does, carry on gardening, it's not all good news, because more than half of Britain's front garden space and a third of back garden space is paved over, reducing its beneficial impact for wildlife. But it doesn't also impact on wildlife. It impacts on flood resistance and prevention and carbon storage. We talk about this a lot on the Live Science Radio Show. Interestingly, the article said artificial lawns still only make up 0.15% of gardens, but this is thought to be growing.
Thank you.
Oh, fantastic track that. I could listen to it over and over again. That's The Garden by the wonderful Mr. Bill Nelson. That's from 1982. Played that. I was talking about the Royal Horticultural Society this week publishing a report for the first time, which talks about the fact that it's mapped Britain's gardens and lots of facts and figures to do with that. Fantastic. You're, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Our PG should be on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
On this rather sunny Saturday morning, make the most of all this sunshine.
It's lovely, isn't it?
It is, before the clocks change and we slip into winter.
Oh, I know, but an extra hour in bed.
Eh? Oh, hey, can't be bad, can it? So what's caught your eye in the science news this week then, Paul?
Oh, a couple of bits. Not particularly science, the first one is it's World Pasta Day today.
To
celebrate the contribution of pasta to feeding the world. It's a regular thing. And also, that made me have a look at some of the other World Days. And there's a World Pizza Bitcoin Day.
Oh, where'd you get it from?
The whole thing behind the World Pizza Bitcoin Day is apparently to celebrate the first Bitcoin transaction. And a chap in Florida spent 10,000 Bitcoins on two pizzas. So now the Bitcoin community have a World Pizza Bitcoin Day.
Who'd have thought it?
Good stuff. Anyway, I've been on my hobby horse about the what's happening with COVID vaccination.
Oh, you have.
And,
have they banned you from your local pharmacy yet then?
No. I thought I'd try and have a look at what may have made the difference. So I came across an article. You can find it on sciencedirect.com. And it's about the cost-effectiveness of routine COVID-19 adult vaccination programs in England. Wow. So, it's in England, as with many other countries, with SARS-CoV-2 infection or COVID-19, the immunity has been through natural infection, primary and booster vaccination, while protection has been lost through the waning immunity and viral mutation. So, basically, we've kept it under control with boosters, but slowly things have changed. And if you looked into the background of what your booster jab was, they've changed the different suppliers and different approaches of, I think, three vaccines to keep things under control. So looking at what kind of science goes into this is then they actually did this study using data from 23 and 24 in England on COVID-19 hospital admissions, intensive care unit admissions, deaths, coupled with the bespoke health economic costs. We consider the willingness to pay threshold for COVID-19 vaccines in different age and risk groups. Okay.
That's so an interesting one, yeah.
Yeah, willingness to pay thresholds vary from less than £1 for younger age groups without any risk factors to over £100 for older age groups with comorbidities that place them at risk. So this non-linear dependence on age means that despite the different method of estimating vaccine effectiveness, there's a considerable qualitative agreement on the willingness to pay threshold for which ages it's most cost-effective to vaccinate. And it shows that those 65 and over in the autumn of 23 and those over 75 in the spring 23 programme aligns with their cost-effective threshold for pre-purchase vaccine, which the only cost was administration, because basically they give a zero cost to the vaccine because they've already bought it, which is a bit of a strange one. So, sort of looking at it, and they looked at the world development, causation of it, and the approaches. So I think, by comparison, I think America's dropping any free vaccines this year, as far as I can tell, but it is in a bit of a turmoil because the person who's in charge of that is a notorious anti-vaxxer.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like a lot of things that are coming out of the American administration. It's very muddled at the moment. But they studied the population, and through their analysis on this study, they stratified the adult population to 16 different age cohorts, from 15 to 19 to 90 plus. And three different risk groups, not at risk, at risk, but not immunosuppressed and immunosuppressed. And the immunosuppressed group accounts for only 1.7% of the English population, peaking at 4.9% for those between 80 and 84 years of age. So they're looking at your age and they're looking at the issues. And again, looking at the graphs they provide, spring and autumn are the peaks for infections, and as already flagged up this year, they're expecting a bit of a surge in the hospitals and the care world, so that's in respect to what they know of the peaks, because again, sort of travelling locally on the tram, people seem to want to close the windows, hermetically seal everything because it's cold, and anything that people are passing around, because SARS and COVID is passed by water droplets in the air. It's not surprising that things start to pick up. And I have to admit, I've actually seen a few people wearing masks
in
the last couple of weeks. So I think some people are trying to protect themselves from it. But they're studying this over the time periods, intervals of 26 weeks. And that kind of correlates to what they're saying is, if you've had a booster, then it's valid for 3 to 6 months. If you've had an infection, it's probably valid for 3 months, but could be longer. So, sort of working on that premise, they looked at the time pattern of vaccination and severe outcomes in hospital admissions to see if there's a correlation in that area. But the statistics they're looking at is aggregating the approach, which is the first method. Then they look at the time since vaccination approach, which is the second method, and then literature-based vaccine effectiveness, which is the third. And finally, they say, which is this method three, the effectiveness values and levels of protection against Omicron have been calculated by multiple other groups, with estimates from the UK providing high-quality early estimates. And they use two recent estimates from the UK and Public Health Scotland in September and March of 23. So September 23, March 24. So a little bit sort of behind the loop with some of the inputs. But then they sort of push this back into the willingness to pay thresholds. So it's based on the maximum likelihood and estimates valuing one quality adjusted life year, right, which is costed at £20,000, the threshold of which is 90% of scenarios are cost effective, using a £30,000 quality of life for full accounting for uncertainty. confusing. I find it very confusing. There's a wonderful thing, chapter 14A in the Green Book, which is published by gov.uk, and that's kind of trying to look at that through the lens of what groups are going to be available. But amongst the statistical factors they looked at was the morbidity rates. And in terms of the UK, the sort of 70 to 75 group comes out with the highest morbidity rates. And immediately that's sort of checked with comorbidity. So that's if you're that age and you've got some other illness, how much of that illness contributes towards the outcomes that you have from COVID. And I'll say that group is about 70%, something like that, of the morbidity outcomes, which is quite startling. But it appears that if you are looking for your COVID booster, then you're not likely to get one if you don't have the immunosuppressed diseases. And a lot of other things seem to have been wiped off that that calculation this year. And there's very little to say what the scientific choices for changing that access to COVID boosters. So it's intriguing to some extent, I think. They actually look at things like considering a £25, £50 and £75 cost for the vaccine and administration. They use £25 per dose delivered. All methods broadly agree with the universal vaccination, those that are aged over 75, and they are indeed included in the COVID booster. 75 to 79 is the age group. And looking at everybody else, then the calculations go through from a pound to somewhat over £100. And I think, as I mentioned last week, was it, that checking on the cost for a lot of the providers that will give you a COVID jab that you pay for, it's averaging just a very small scrape under the £100 mark. So it's amazing, but the degree of use of statistics, and I think it sort of brings straight to mind the old adage about statistics: lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Ooh, Paul! And the sun's actually shining today. But yeah, you know, there's a couple of things I'm going to ask you. Number one, what about herd immunity? Then all this issue about herd immunity. They're pretty hot on that at the minute for younger people, children not being vaccinated.
Well, I think there's always been that as a counterbalance. I think in America they were very tempted by herd immunity from the outset. And I think if you look at herd immunity, then you can have a look at the massive countries like China and say, well, yeah, you could play around with herd immunity, which they didn't. But they could do, because basically there are plenty of people. If there's a percentage that you're going to lose, there'll be quite a high percentage of people who survive. And that's the real nub of herd immunity, is to say, well, okay, you know, I mean, we might go through this and X percentage of people we guess are going to survive it. But looking at these statistics, they're talking about reinfections. Now, when they're looking at that, it's not particularly clear. I think I'll say you can get it to, as a downloadable PDF if you want to spend a lot of your life looking through it. But basically, that's the choice for a lot of these things. So, looking at it, it is, say, identifiably sort of two variations at the beginning, but now there have been several different variations over the period from 2019, I think, when we first started reporting it.
Yeah, yeah, we did.
It's sort of come through, and it's a calculation on risk. So at the moment, they're using the actual data from up to 24 to predict 25 and onwards. But you know, the variations are dependent on things like how severe a winter we have, because people have become more susceptible over that period. And again, in early 26, how severely cold the spring might be, because it kind of keeps people indoors, keeps people together more, which increases transmissibility of the disease. So it's interesting, but as I say, there's not a clear sort of straightforward answer that I can find on the NHS sites anywhere to say why they appear to have changed the rules this last year.
But there's not been much said about it, I think, Paul. Has there?
No, that's what I say. You know, I mean, it's one of those things that we're so used to having tons of data thrown out and tons of leaflets sent out and wonderful texts on the sort of automated systems from government telling us about it. It's suddenly gone very quiet, and amongst that change, you suddenly find a lot of people are going to be coughing up this £100 rather than whatever else you cough up with COVID.
Yeah, but am I right in thinking, Paul, that flu jabs are just being rolled out as they would normally be?
Yeah, and again, I sort of had a look at that because I really wondered, and it said that flu is actually a combination of diseases. So basically, again, it's a bit of a statistical prediction. They look at places like Canada and Australia to try and get in front of the curve for what will happen in the UK. And from that, they predict which cocktail of medicine they can put out for the flu jab. And I think famously the year for me was the one where they'd used Australian data and the actual flu in the UK was different. And I had a terrible dose of flu that year, so it was great.
Yeah,
great to see.
But, you know, COVID is a type of flu. It's a similar viral disease, isn't it? So what I'm trying to get to the bottom of is why the flu vaccine's been rolled out as it would normally, but the view on COVID vaccines has changed.
Yeah, exactly. And I say, at the moment, apart from this in-depth sort of statistical analysis, there doesn't seem to be a clear answer for that. And again, it's one of those things which is perturbing, especially when the age group who have been offered the free vaccination before have now been dropped out of it, and that coincides with the group which has the highest morbidity rate.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Anyway,
oh dear.
Apart from that, what a ray of sunshine. Maybe what I'll switch to is something you've touched upon, but I was intrigued by it, and that's about blind people being given sight by technology.
Yes.
And it's an article by Fergus Walsh on the BBC, and it's talking about life-changing eye implants for blind patients being able to read again. And it is a trial at Moorfields Hospital, Eye Hospital in London, as I think you mentioned. And it's really, well, okay, how does it work? So it was actually a trial of an approach that the tech was built by American bioscience company called Science Corporation. And it's the Prima implant, and that was actually used at Moorfields in 5 patients in a trial. And the surgeon who actually made the implants was amazed at how good the results were for it. So it also covered patients of 5 European countries in the trial, and this overall there were 38 patients involved. 32 of those were given the implants, and 27 were able to read again using the system around the implants and an additional thing with a camera on special spectacles. And after 1 year, the results, the people's vision had generally improved by 5 lines on the eye chart.
Wow.
So that's an amazing thing. And what's doing it? Well, it's a tiny 2 millimetre square photovoltaic cell, which is implanted behind the retina. And it's a photovoltaic chip. So it converts photo light into, and that voltage is used to pass on information to a pocket system outside the body, and it's the chip itself is about the thickness of a human hair, so it's a really tiny implant. Once it's been put under the retina, the patient then wears special glasses with an inbuilt camera. And that camera senses the infrared that is red, and that inputs to this pocket device, which changes the voltages around and uses the information produced to improve the outline, the contrast, and the overall visibility of the lettering. So patients have to spend several months getting used to the system and utilising it. And the pocket processor enhances the text, makes it clearer. The lady in the article who the spoke about her receiving the implant said it was out of this world, the improvement, and the technology gives hopes to sufferers. So it's looking at a particular thing, which is dry age related macular degeneration, and that's often just called AMD, but it's also called geographic atrophy. That's GA in brackets, and it affects more than 250,000 people in the UK. Worldwide, there are over 5 million people affected by it. So it's a wonderful application of technology. and in some respects, I know, I think we talked in the past about the readers that can actually speak some of the text. So basically, that basic thing in terms of the visual part of it, the reader does apply some of these things to sharpen edges, to clarify what's in front of the camera. And that used to be a device that blind people would carry to try and read line by line things, but this is actually allowing the patient, with the aid of the glasses, with the camera in, to read again.
It's a great story, and it makes you realise they put all those different bits of technology together to bring forward that solution, which is a game changer for people with that condition.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's like a lot of things. You know, I mean, I think there's been sort of news about people being treated for Parkinson's again, and I've spoken about it before, where you have an electronic implant fitted, and that helps to counter the sort of instability in gait and grip that you get in Parkinson's. And I worked on a program a long time ago which used that basic technology that's been developed and moved out into a lot of other areas where it's a sort of neurological response, and it helps to control that and make life a bit more livable for people.
Amazing. We're going to have to let you go now, Paul, because the film show are waiting to get in. But you've chosen a fantastic track. Good old Johnny Cash.
Nash.
Yeah.
Oh, Johnny Nash. Sorry, I thought it was Johnny Cash. I can see clearly now the rain has gone.
Okay.
Amazing. Speak to you Monday, Paul. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I can see clearly now the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way. Gone are the dark clouds that had me blind. It's gonna be a bright sunshiny day. It's gonna be bright, sunshiny day. I think I can.